This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Der Handel an den Weltfinanzmärkten ist nicht einfach. Doch nur weil der Handel etwas schwierig sein kann, heißt das nicht, dass Ihr Broker es auch sein muss. Bei Kapital.com möchten wir Ihnen den Handel so einfach wie möglich machen. Ganz gleich, ob Sie ein Konto eröffnen oder eine Position auf unserer übersichtlichen, benutzerfreundlichen Plattform eröffnen möchten. Schauen Sie noch heute bei Kapital.com vorbei und finden Sie heraus, wie wir Ihnen helfen können, intelligenter zu handeln. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld. Geht es Ihnen nicht auch auf die Nerven, wenn ein Unternehmen mit all seinen Auszeichnungen prahlt? Uns auch. Fühlt sich so aufgesetzt an, oder? Mit uns von Kapital.com können Sie sich also wieder Ihrem Podcast widmen. Übrigens haben wir bei den 2024 Online Money Awards die Auszeichnung Best Overall Trading Plattform erhalten. Oh, ups. Kapital.com. Viel besser in Sachen Trading als in Sachen Werbung. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Hello, I'm Julian Warwicker. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 10th of March. Following a collision between an oil tanker and a cargo vessel in the North Sea, we're asking how something like this can happen in broad daylight and what the environmental implications are. As the government outlines more details of its planning reform, how can it placate people who don't want to live close to new electricity pylons? And one of the original architects working on the design of the Pompidou Centre in Paris in the 1970s tells us what he thinks of it closing for renovations for the next 5 years. Well, the alarm was raised at 9:48 this morning. That's when news began to emerge of a collision in the North Sea involving an American tanker and a cargo ship sailing under a Portuguese flag. It happened about 10 miles off the East Yorkshire coast, close to the Humber estuary. There was a huge explosion and a major maritime rescue operation has been going on ever since. The American ship was carrying aviation fuel, some of which is pouring into the sea. It's emerged that the Portuguese vessel had 15 containers of sodium cyanide, a highly poisonous substance, on board. We'll talk more about the environmental implications of this collision in a moment. First, the latest from our correspondent Rowan Bridge, who's in Grimsby. Rowan, it was initially believed, wasn't it, that everybody on board these two ships had been accounted for, but then we heard these reports of one person who's missing. What's the latest on all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you often see in these sorts of chaotic situations is there's an element of confusion about what's happened, and you kind of saw that play out today. So as of early this evening, the situation appeared to be that everyone had been accounted for. And then just after seven, there was a statement issued by the owners of Salong, the container vessel involved in the accident. And that said that one of their crew members was missing. And then in the last half an hour or so, really, the Coast Guard have said that their search for that missing crew member has been called off. Interestingly, also this evening, I managed to speak to a few of the crew of the Stena Immaculate, the oil tanker involved in this. They said that the Salon came out of the blue when it struck them at 16 knots, that they'd escaped into lifeboats and had been towed to shore. And from what I could tell, they had basically escaped with what they had on them. The person I spoke to had got off the ship with his wallet and his mobile phone, and basically that was it, the clothes he was standing in. And I caught up with them. They were in the local Asda buying clothes and toiletries because they basically had nothing with them whatsoever.
And what's the next stage now in the emergency response?
Both of these vessels are still on fire this evening. The Coast Guard say their aircraft are monitoring the situation. The other issue that there is concern about is the potential environmental damage caused by all of this. We know that the Stena Immaculate oil tanker is leaking its cargo of jet fuel, as you say, into the sea. The Salon, the cargo ship, is carrying 15 containers which have the toxic chemical sodium cyanide in it, as you were talking about. What's not clear is what has happened to those 15 containers. Are they still on board the Salon? Have they been breached at all? We don't know. That's not clear at the moment. The concern, though, is that there is a threat both from that jet fuel and from the sodium cyanide to aquatic and wildlife in the area. The RSPB, for example, have said they're extremely concerned about the potential impact on the marine environment if this stuff is leaking into the sea.
Rowan Bridge in Grimsby, thank you very much. So how can this sort of collision, where a ship collides with a stationary vessel in open water in daylight, still happen in an era of radar and advanced navigation systems? Well, Dr. Stavros Karamparidis is a lecturer in maritime economics and head of the Maritime Transport Research Group at the University of Plymouth. Doctor, welcome. Good evening.
Good evening, Dean. Thank you for having me.
I'd imagine that's a question that you are asking yourself as well, isn't it?
Truly. Since morning when I heard the news, it's like, for me, that's the $1 million question. How on earth the two vessels they managed to collide with itself, and well, especially the one was totally stationary. And it's not only the radars, as you say, that the vessels are having on board, is the AES system, which is the automated identification system. That, you know, they are there in order to prevent all those things happening. And we have thousands of vessels operating, as you know, in the Channel, which is a very busy area in the English Channel and also around the UK. So it's that's a huge concern how that has happened.
We assume, do we, human error of some sort?
Yes, that's the logical, but of course we shouldn't be really saying something before the officials come to the scene and, you know, finish all the investigation. You know, at the moment, I think the first priority is to find out everybody. Your reporter early on mentioned that, unfortunately, one person is missing. I hope we can find that one person quite soon. If it's still missing or it's not, I don't know. I was a bit confused, and hopefully that wasn't that chaotic. But as you can imagine, when a vessel with 60 knots hits another one, and of course you have fire coming on into the scene, then of course a lot of chaos can happen. But of course, thankfully, it was a very good and rapid response, and so far we managed to avoid the worst case scenario.
I mean, given the speed of the moving vessel and obviously the scale of the fire that we've seen on our television screen since, which is still burning, would you have feared a higher casualty count than we've actually had?
As you rightly said, from what we've seen on our screens, yes, it would be, you know, it could easily be something worse than that. But I hope, as I said, that, you know, we're not having any losses at the moment. You know, it's early to discuss about how many people have been lost, you know, until the officials make any kind of statements. And it's not fair for the families of the seafarers, because, you know, the seafarers are operating in very remote conditions. You know, you can imagine the anxiety of the family members. So it's better to be skeptical on what we're saying, because, you know, I have a lot of friends working in the sea, and I can imagine all the agony that the family themselves are going through at the moment.
Absolutely. What of the investigation? What does it prioritize at this point, do you think?
I think that the first initial hours is just to make sure that everybody's safe and make sure that, you know, everybody has managed to get away from that hell on water, because you've seen the fire and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's like it was very tragic, the overall situation, how it evolved and with the fire. And of course, the collision of the two vessels. Thankfully, the vessels are still floating, and there is a lot of operation going there in terms to contaminate the fire, which is great. And I think after we make sure that, you know, all the possible actions have been taken in order to save lives, then I think the second action, second in terms of priority, but I'm sure already the authorities have done that, they will try to mitigate any kind of environmental impact that, you know, the oil that we have that is pouring into the ocean is taking place. So I'm sure they're going to put a lot of defenses, water defenses around, so they can minimize any environmental impact from that accident.
Thank you very much for coming on, Dr. Stavros Karamparidis from the University of Plymouth. Well, as we were saying, both ships were carrying potentially hazardous cargo. The tanker, the Stena Immaculate, had an estimated 130,000 barrels of jet fuel on board. The Solong, the cargo ship, was carrying 15 containers of highly toxic sodium cyanide. So how much environmental damage could there be as a result of this? Alistair Hay is on the line, Professor of Environmental Toxicology at the University of Leeds. Alistair Hay, good evening.
Good evening.
Let's talk about sodium cyanide, first of all. How dangerous is that, potentially?
Well, sodium cyanide is a very potent cell poison. Cyanide disrupts the mechanism in all cells in the body, and it disrupts the mechanism of producing energy, and basically cells fail, and the devastation really depends on the quantity of cyanide that the cells are exposed to. So you're talking, say, for about a 70 kilogram individual, a fatal dose will be about 150 milligrams. So just over a tenth of a gram would be fatal for a 70 kilogram person. Very potent.
In containers, and hopefully still in containers, is part of this, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. So as long as it is containerized, then there is minimum risk. And listening to that earlier discussion you had there, hopefully if the ships stay afloat, the containers will remain intact. Fire and also contact with water will cause containers with hydrogen of sodium cyanide to explode. So there is a risk, but the attempts to try and quell the flames and hopefully try and keep the vessels afloat will minimize the risk hugely.
What of the threat posed by the jet fuel?
Well, jet fuel is a mixture of about 200 compounds. It's been refined over the years to get something that's very efficient, obviously, for aircraft. It's not as toxic as crude oil, but jet fuel is mainly based on kerosene. And the mixture of kerosene and other components depends on the oil that was the initial source of the material. It is, as I said, less toxic than oil, but still toxic. But in relation to cyanide, a 50th to an 80th less toxic, or as toxic as cyanide. So cyanide would be 50 to 80 times more toxic than jet fuel.
How much of a threat do you think we're talking about here to local wildlife, potentially?
Well, if everything stays containerized in relation to the cyanide, minimal risk. If the cyanide containers did rupture and all of that material entered the water, it would be a significant pollution risk. And fish would be particularly vulnerable, and any marine life as well. So it very much depends on how much is released. Mm. With relation to the jet fuel, the fuel is very volatile, so a lot of it will evaporate. The time that it is in the atmosphere, I mean, in general, the what's called the half-life, the time for the concentration to fall by half, is just over a day or so. So it gradually sort of breaks down, and stuff in the water, well, that's degraded by bacteria eventually. But if the concentration is, you know, significant, then there could be problems for marine life.
Alistair Hay, thank you very much for coming on the programme. In the last few moments, the Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, has issued a statement on all of this. She said, "I'm hugely grateful to His Majesty's Coast Guard, the RNLI and emergency services who've responded to this incident. They were on the scene swiftly, have helped rescue those in immediate danger, and I know they will continue to work tirelessly over the coming days. My thoughts are with all those involved, especially the family of the missing crew member." She concludes, "The Maritime Accident Investigation Branch has become a preliminary assessment, and I'm working closely with the MCA as they conduct an assessment of any counter-pollution response which may be required over the coming days." Coming up later.
For 3 years, there was a lot of friction between the French Architectural Institute and us upstarts from another country to do a building which was radically different than anything else in Paris. But in the end, we knew would be a success, because what our hearts said is that it was a building that would respond to the needs of new times.
As Paris's Pompidou Centre shuts down for a 5-year refurbishment, we'll speak to the man who contributed to the original vision for the famous building. Now, with so much political attention on international matters of late, there's been a reminder today of the government's domestic agenda and the challenges they face to deliver it. The Planning and Infrastructure Bill is being published this week. It aims to speed up the building of new homes and infrastructure by cutting red tape and simplifying the planning process. And the government has put the changes at the heart of its push for economic growth. Among other things, there'll be measures taken to meet clean energy targets, and that will mean hundreds of miles of new pylons. Well, those are fiercely opposed in some areas by people like Rosie Pearson in East Anglia. She leads the Essex, Suffolk, Norfolk Pylons Action Group and spoke to BBC Suffolk today.
There's nothing NIMBY about wanting the right proposal for the region. And as I've said, there are many alternatives that are better than pylons. We accept the need to upgrade the grid. We accept the need for wind power in the North Sea. But there are at least three better, cheaper, more popular ways of doing things that will result in a quicker grid upgrade if they actually listen to us. And they are not listening to the communities that are affected. And instead, they're proposing things that simply won't make any difference and will make this worse for bill payers all over the country.
Well, two senior government ministers, Angela Rayner and Ed Miliband, have been out and about today explaining more about the government's plans. Our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth, was with them and she told me how they were looking to respond to their critics.
I think it's hard for them not to be aware as a government because, of course, some of the campaign groups against this notion of lots of pylons in the countryside have been very vocal about it and have been urging the government to look at alternative options. So I think that was in the mind of ministers. And what Ed Miliband said was that he believed that this was essential to effectively transport or distribute the clean energy to where it needs to go. So he was saying that as part of an incentive, I suppose, that he was going to say to people who lived within 500 metres of these new pylons that they could get up to £250 a year off their energy bills for as long as a decade. Now, I did say to him, look, are you buying people off? But he said to me, no, this is about recognising that there will be an impact on the communities that might live near this infrastructure and it's about giving them something back. This is what the Energy Secretary had to say.
What we're saying is everyone benefits from clean homegrown power, but if you are living near a pylon, you're doing a service to the whole country by having that pylon in your area. We need to recognise that. That's why we get up to £250 a year off your bills for a decade, and that's a sign that we recognise, if you like, the service that people are doing for the whole country.
Who's going to pay for that?
That is going to be spread across all bill payers. It's about 80p a year for all bill payers, but actually...
So the people near the pylons get a discount, but everyone else pays?
But the costs of that are more than offset by getting that transmission infrastructure built. At the moment, we're having to switch off offshore wind farms because we haven't got the transmission infrastructure, so everybody benefits from this.
Now, one of the other big elements of this debate is housing, Alex, which takes us to Angela Rayner. What she said about how she will try to speed up house building.
You're completely right. There's sort of two elements of this big bit of legislation, which has been long awaited, I think it's fair to say, are the infrastructure element and then the housing element. And what Angela Rayner is saying, and in fact what the government is planning to do, and we don't know all of the detail of this legislation yet, but it is, in their words, trying to remove some of the bureaucracy around the planning system and speed up the decisions around some big developments. So that might be things like, for infrastructure projects, looking at how many legal challenges people can bring to certain infrastructure projects, looking at the number of statutory bodies or organisations that have to be consulted about developments before they take place. And on housing, it might be looking at which specific housing developments have to go before committees of councillors at local level for approval and which ones don't. So the whole idea is about speeding up and getting more homes built. Of course, the other side to that is there are some who fear that that may mean the voices of people in their local communities who don't want a particular development get squeezed out. So I put that to the Deputy Prime Minister and the Housing Secretary.
I don't think it's about being unpopular. I think it's about proving to people that what I'm saying is what we're going to do.
But there's
people
a lot of opposition to a lot of development in a lot of pockets of the country.
When I speak to people, there's not one person that doesn't recognise the crisis that we face at the moment in terms of housing. I've got 1.3 million people on the housing waiting list, 160,000 children in temporary accommodation. People know people in their family that are desperate to get on the ladder to have their first home. They understand the challenge we face. What they want to see is a government that is going to put the investment in around the infrastructure and making sure that there's green spaces and that we protect the environment. And this government is on their side. We're going to build and we're going to preserve our nature as part of that.
Now, there are potentially one or two other unpopular decisions in the offing, aren't there? Welfare cuts, for example, another. What's your sense, Alex, of how the mood in the parliamentary party is as it approaches these decisions?
Yeah, fairly well-trailed cuts to the welfare budget that we expect when Rachel Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, stands up in Parliament in a couple of weeks' time. And that will come along at the same time that she's given forecasts by the Office of Budget Responsibility, which gives some indication about the state of public finances. Now, the government is effectively making the case for reducing the welfare bill because they, in their words, call it a moral obligation or a duty to get people who are not in work back into work. But it's definitely fair to say there is some consternation within Labour MPs, backbench MPs in particular, about this issue. You know, you have to remember that some of these MPs say that they were politicised or got involved in politics, particularly the new intake of Labour MPs, through 2010 and beyond, when there was that period of austerity. And what they don't want to see is this government doing anything that looks like they're going down that path. But it is all worth saying, Julian, there is another group of MPs, they're called the Get Britain Working Group, who are very much supporting the approach that we're expecting to hear from the Work and Pension Secretary and from the Chancellor regarding the welfare budget, and making the point that actually the welfare budget has increased substantially, particularly for people of working age, and they want to see that budget come down. So we don't know the details, to be frank, about what they are looking at in terms of reducing the welfare bill or what that might involve. But it definitely has the potential to be an issue that could be quite divisive on the Labour backbenches.
Our political correspondent, Alex.
Der Handel an den Weltfinanzmärkten ist nicht einfach. Doch nur weil der Handel etwas schwierig sein kann, heißt das nicht, dass Ihr Broker es auch sein muss. Bei Kapital.com möchten wir Ihnen den Handel so einfach wie möglich machen. Ganz gleich, ob Sie ein Konto eröffnen oder eine Position auf unserer übersichtlichen, benutzerfreundlichen Plattform eröffnen möchten. Schauen Sie noch heute bei Kapital.com vorbei und finden Sie heraus, wie wir Ihnen helfen können, intelligenter zu handeln. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Now think of a bouncer, especially one you might encounter on the doors of a nightclub, and you probably have in mind a man rather than a woman, and a man of distinctive girth and demeanour, someone you wouldn't mess with, in other words, someone Arctic Monkeys had in mind, maybe, in From the Ritz to the Rubble.
Well, last night these two bouncers, and one of them's all right, the other one's a scary, and his way or no way, totalitarian. He's got no time for you, looking or breathing, how he don't want you to. So step out the queue, he makes examples of you.
Well, some of those assumptions about bouncers need challenging, according to the head of the Association for Security Industry Workers. Heather Bailey wants more women to take on the role because they bring a skill set, she says, which includes the ability to diffuse conflict and also to be more approachable if another woman is being pestered and needs help. Part of the problem, she says, is the word bouncer. She wants rid of it and to see it replaced by a term which is less macho. Lexicographer Susie Dent, famous for her role on the Channel 4 quiz Countdown, has been looking into the origins of the word.
The dictionary would certainly bear out the negative associations, because its very first meaning in the 18th century was a braggart, or a sort of hectoring individual who strutted their stuff, you know, a boaster or a bully. And then in thieves slang, or cant as it was once known, a bouncer was a cheat. So someone who was considered underhand, even in the sort of criminal underworld, if you like. It's not really had a particularly good reputation since it first appeared. And its modern meaning of someone hired to eject unruly people from clubs, etc., bouncing or chucking them out, is from North America in the sort of 1860s. And in British English at the time, actually, they were called the chucker out. So it was always an informal term. I'm not sure it was ever designed to be a formal one.
Heather Bailey, who's the woman who wants to change this and get rid of the word, she's the head of the Security Industry Authority, says, "I think it brings connotations of a large, muscular man, and it's macho. And that, from her point of view, is not a good thing."
I can absolutely see that. As I say, I think particularly if 11% of door supervisors, or whatever we want to call them, are women. The thing I would always say as a lexicographer is that you can't really impose change from the top down. So it's very difficult to petition for a change and for that to then be realised in the dictionary, which is really the only authority we have. We don't have an academy as such. We don't have anyone prescribing how words are used. So it has to come from the users. And when people blame words, they're usually blaming the society that uses them.
And when you look at other job titles over the years, and how they have changed and the reason that they've changed, what do you highlight?
the sort of uptitling that we see. And I think the idea of bigging up certain roles has been around for a long time. In the 1940s, rat catchers like to call themselves rodent operatives, which sounds so modern to our ears. I know there was a campaign fairly recently for newspapers to stop using the word boffin whenever they were talking about an expert. Others find it quite affectionate. Some people found it quite reductive and quite demeaning. Apparently, those of us who have been shelf stackers in supermarkets, some of them have been renamed stock replenishment executives, for example. But to the outside, that change is unlikely to sort of really take hold. I think that's more for sort of job descriptions and quite rightly to give people confidence in their jobs. But I think if we're to find an alternative to bouncer, I think it has to be something that is still specific enough so that it's not diluted so much that actually it becomes meaningless.
Door supervisors or licensed operatives, I read.
Door supervisor, I can see. I mean, there's quite an interesting point made that actually there is far more to this than actually going back to that chucking out business. You know, that actually they can help people in need. They have a sort of a caring and a protective role as well. And that's certainly not reflected in bouncers. So it would be nice to find something that actually reflects that wider role, particularly if there are women in the job. I think it's been pointed out that women who feel threatened are more likely than to approach a woman. So it'd be nice to reflect that aspect, I think, in the job title.
Do these changes always help communication? I mean, going back to the shelf stacker, but if a shelf stacker becomes a stock replenishment executive, most people wouldn't have the first idea what that person actually did.
That is exactly the point, because they become so untethered from the actual job that they do become slightly meaningless. I think this goes for language in general. There's so much hyperbole around whereby everything is tragic, so that things that are truly, genuinely tragic have to have sort of other adjectives piled on in front of them to sort of really get the same effect. Likewise, everyone's a star if they even hold the door open for you, or even weather forecasts now are sort of packed full of hyperbole. So I don't know if at some point we will return to a sort of calmer, less inflationary style whereby we actually say it as it is. And I think there's definitely room here for a retitling. I would just say be careful that it doesn't become too clinical and too removed from the reality.
Lexicographer Susie Dent. The main headlines so far on The World Tonight. The Coast Guard has confirmed that one person is still missing after a collision between two vessels in the North Sea caused large fires on both. Shares on Wall Street have suffered falls following President Trump's refusal to rule out a recession. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio says Washington could restart military and intelligence support for Ukraine if progress is made in peace talks. And in another headline, the MP Mike Amesbury has told the BBC he will stand down as soon as possible after being convicted of assaulting one of his constituents in Cheshire last year. The 55-year-old has been sitting as an independent since he was suspended by Labour in October. His resignation will trigger a by-election in the Runcorn and Helsby constituency, the first of Sir Keir Starmer's government. Well, he spoke to our political correspondent, Hannah Miller.
Paul Fellows said your punch could have killed him.
Yes.
He's right, isn't he?
And therefore the grace of God, you know. So that's why it's important. I own it. I've made a huge mistake. I've apologised very publicly.
Very publicly, but not personally.
I'm happy to do it personally. Yes, happy to do it personally.
MP Mike Amesbury speaking to Hannah Miller. A former senior executive at Facebook has told the BBC that the social media site once worked with the Chinese authorities to develop censorship tools to try to operate in China. It's one of many allegations in a book by Sarah Wynne Williams, who was the company's global director of public policy. Facebook's parent company, Meta, says she was fired for poor performance and is suing the publisher. Our culture and media editor, Katie Razzle, spoke to the whistleblower.
Woman, you do with that, young one.
This is Mark Zuckerberg, who learnt Mandarin more than a decade ago. For years, there have been questions about the lengths that the Facebook, now Meta boss, went to try to persuade the Chinese authorities to allow his social network into China.
He was working hand in glove with the Chinese Communist Party, building a censorship tool.
This is Sarah Wynne Williams.
Sort of the antithesis of many of the principles that underpin Facebook.
She's a former director of global public policy for Facebook, and she claims the company was less than open about its conversations with the Chinese government.
What is your evidence for that?
My evidence, I have many, many hundreds of documents. China is Mark Zuckerberg's white whale. It's the one country on the risk board game that he hasn't conquered. It's been one of his top priorities for nearly a decade.
The BBC has seen some documents dating from the time of her employment in which Meta executives discuss negotiations with China, including developing censorship tools that might allow them to operate there. Sarah Wynne-Williams described one of those tools to us.
Anytime a post or a photo or whatever got more than 10,000 views, it would automatically be sent for moderation.
Facebook told the BBC it doesn't operate in China. And while it is no secret it was once interested in doing so, it ultimately opted not to go through with the ideas it had explored, which Mark Zuckerberg announced in 2019. Wynne-Williams, alongside publishing a book, Careless People, about her time at Facebook between 2011 and 2017, has filed a whistleblowing complaint to the US Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates financial markets.
Meta told us that you were terminated in 2017 and an investigation at that time found you made false claims.
So I really wish they would tell the truth. That was actually an investigation I instigated around some behavioural experience from my boss. And if they're now saying that that's the reason that I was terminated, that is fascinating.
Meta says she was dismissed for poor performance and toxic behaviour.
You are making some very serious claims about a company that fired you. You're a disgruntled employee with an axe to grind, aren't you?
Not at all. I'm someone who really cares about this company and has devoted so much of my life to it and thinks it can do better.
And she has some insights into the character of Meta's billionaire leader.
Mark sort of looks at the world as a board game, you know, like Risk, and he just wants to occupy every territory.
And you played board games with him?
I did, although not well, as it turned out.
What do you mean by that?
I didn't realise that you were supposed to let him win. I was a little naive.
And in the book, I mean, you do have some fascinating insights about, for example, his timekeeping in terms of when he wants to have meetings. You were out there setting up meetings for him with global leaders. And what were the rules?
No matter what happened, even when we got him this incredible opportunity to keynote at the United Nations, like, that's still not enough to get him out of bed before midday.
So he works late, is it? Is that the reason?
Yeah, he works late. But the things that I worked on, working with presidents and prime ministers, they're used to having their schedule take priority. They're not going to have infinite time to work around whenever Mark wants to roll out of bed.
You were introducing Mark Zuckerberg to world leaders. How did you see attitudes change over the time you were there at that company?
So it was a complete 180. When I started, it was very hard to get anyone senior to engage with us. You know, someone at the level of prime minister didn't want to be meeting with some college kid's hobby site. But towards the end of my time, we managed to engineer a situation where Mark was presiding over all of the most powerful presidents and prime ministers. It was as if these incredibly powerful leaders were there to sort of kiss the ring, that they really saw Mark as fundamental in their future elections, their future more generally. And in contrast, Mark was sort of like a king or a queen, you know, he would be there forever as these people cycled in and out of power.
Facebook whistleblower talking to Katie Razzle. A look at tomorrow's newspaper headlines. The Guardian leads with number of jobless indefensible, says PM, and criticism over cuts, a reference to anticipated welfare cuts and the likely political row for Sir Keir Starmer. The Financial Times front page says Wall Street plunges after Trump's refusal to rule out recession. And the Daily Telegraph leads with farmers hit again in Rayner land grab, referring to Angela Rayner's house building plans. Its report says owners will be forced to sell fields at lower value after a latest attack on rural Britain. Now, 3 months after the reopening of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, another famous building in the city, very much at the other end of the architectural scale, is due to fall silent. It was the first major example of an inside-out building. The Pompidou Centre, unveiled in 1977, remains a striking sight to this day, with its structural system, mechanical systems and circulation exposed on its exterior via a series of colour-coded pipes. Crowds have been flocking to it over the weekend because from today, this iconic art and cultural hub will be closed for renovations and remedial work, work that's due to last for 5 years. The BBC has been speaking to some of its last visitors.
It's a place where I would go often, so it would be a little strange.
There was like an exhibition about the surrealistic movement recently, and it was marvellous. I have no words. Yes, there is a sort of, you know, last day mood, but it's not sad. I would say it's joyful.
It brings a lot of people here, so if it closes, it will be just kind of empty here because there's always this big line of people waiting to come inside.
Well, the centre, named after the French president in the early 1970s, Georges Pompidou, caused uproar. One newspaper reportedly said Paris has its own monster. It was designed by Richard Rogers and Renzo Piano, who won an international competition. Well, someone who was involved with the project from the start as well was the renowned architect Mike Davies, CBE, who went on to work on the Millennium Dome and Terminal 5 of Heathrow. He'd been a student in LA when he got the call to travel to Paris to join the project.
Basically, I arrived in Paris in January 1972, having left LA, I think it was 84 degrees Fahrenheit. We arrived in Paris and it was -9 centigrade. So we jumped from one world to another. Pompidou, of course, didn't exist apart from the concept that Richard and Renzo had put together. So the task was to essentially develop the concept, which was essentially a competition entry, which means 10 drawings, and develop it into a building which could be built fast, right in the heart of Paris.
And when you first saw that plan, how groundbreaking did it immediately look?
Absolutely groundbreaking. It was a radical building, and still is one of the world's most radical buildings. Instead of being a custom building designed for one need, or two needs, it was a building which was essentially a flexible space within which you could, over time, evolve the uses of the building, as in reality, the uses that happen in a building do evolve. Museums change their formats, new technology comes along, new sorts of public interest appears and so on. So you need to adapt buildings.
I suppose the thing that's sort of entering my mind is it was unveiled in the late 1970s in a city like Paris, which you associate in your mind with architecture of a very different type to the type that we're now describing. How conscious were you all that when that building was finally unveiled, it would create the kind of ripples that it did?
Well, we knew that it would, because Paris is a conservative city and its architectural tradition would go back to a very strong master plan from 200 years ago and so on.
And you knew that it would provoke some adverse reactions as well as some positive ones?
Well, of course, absolutely. And there were lots of protests, and the French architects said, well, you know, you can't do this building because you're not a member of the French Institute of Architects. And we said, well, no, but we, our intent has not been to be that. Our intent was to fulfil the orders of the President of France, who organises competition, and said, we've won it, and would you get on and build it, please? So that's what we're doing. So for 3 years, there was a lot of friction between the French Architectural Institute and us upstarts from another country to do a building which was radically different than anything else in Paris. But in the end, we knew would be a success, because what our hearts said is that it was a building that would respond to the needs of new times.
What did you think about its potential longevity at the time? I mean, was it a building that you sat down and thought, this is a building that will last for decades and decades and decades?
Yes, and certainly most big buildings, if they're designed reasonably well, will last for between 50 and 100 years. It depends, obviously, upon the type of material you use.
The reason I ask about its longevity is here we are, 48 years after it was unveiled. And yes. They've got to close it for 5 years.
Now, I don't know why that figure, and I'm not involved in that process at all. I would have thought it could be refurbished in less time than that. But maybe there's politics involved or not, I'm not quite sure.
In 5 years' time, when it reopens, what are your hopes for what it will then be like?
I hope it will retain its principal spirit, which is a spirit of a welcome, because it's an open, transparent building, quite deliberately so. It invites you in. Nobody ever asks you how you go up the building. It's quite obvious at first sight. And it will then offer another 50 years or whatever time they think is reasonable of flexible uses for the public. Some of the world's greatest exhibitions have been held at the Pompidou Centre. I'm very proud of it.
Mike Davis, one of the original architects of the Pompidou Centre. And that's The World Tonight. I'm Julian Warwick. Back tomorrow at 10. But from me and everyone on the programme, good night.